Court is ready to hear argument in the original mandamus proceeding of Spears versus the Fourth Court of Appeals. We've allotted 20 minutes for a relator and respondent to present oral argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. The court is ready to hear oral argument from relator.
Thank you. May it please the court, Bernard Cushman of San Antonio, for the relator, Judge Spears, and the real party in interest, Mr. Jesse Casillas. Your Honors, this presents in a somewhat unusual factual context a case that calls upon you to decide just how far the state of Texas may go in using a dilatory litigation tactic to disqualify counsel for a plaintiff in a personal injury suit brought under the Tort Claims Act from representing that plaintiff. The points of error that we've brought are five in number, and they might be grouped, I suppose, in two sets. The first three of these points are very intensely fact-specific, and these are whether there was a substantial relationship between the prior representation of attorney Margaret Maisel and the case that is now at bar. Secondly, whether Mrs. Maisel is a witness and therefore disqualified under the attorney advocate rule. Thirdly, whether through its failure to raise these points, these first two points, the state waived its motion by failing to timely bring them forward. The last two points, which are whether which simply are the broad issue of the plaintiff's right to counsel of his own choosing, really embraces everything, and it's a legal point, but it's one which is perhaps the overriding consideration here. And then finally, a technical or procedural point, which is that the state has and continues to have an adequate remedy by way of appeal which precluded their petition for mandamus to overturn the relator Judge Spears' ruling. I'd like to reacquaint you briefly with the facts of the case. Margaret Maisel had been appointed by the governor to serve a one-year term as chairman of the Industrial Accident Board. In that capacity, she was the statutory legal advisor to the board, and we make no contention here that the first prong of the so-called substantial relation of the disqualification test was not met. Technically, statutorily, she was the attorney for the board, but that is as far as that goes in this case. She was appointed, and her term was to expire, as it happens. Tomorrow would be the fifth anniversary of that, October the 5th, 1985. She had been appointed in August of 84. On September the 25th, 1985, approximately 9 days before her term was to be over and she not being reappointed, Mr. Casillas, our client, plaintiff, was in the offices of the board for a hearing in San Antonio of another worker in his company, Fred Fishfry, who was injured, and he was there at the request of his employer to give testimony favorable to the employer. He was invited to take a chair. He sat down in the chair collapsed, he was injured. Plain and simple, plain vanilla tort claims case. Mrs. Maisel was informed by Mr. Tracy, the executive director of the board, sometime within those 9 days, and frankly the record doesn't tell us when, but we can see that she was told this, that an accident had happened, a chair had collapsed, and a man might have been injured. She wasn't told the name of the person. She didn't see the accident happen. She didn't render any legal advice. She wasn't consulted. She didn't volunteer her opinion. Nothing happened other than she told Mr. Tracy, we'll have the chairs checked out throughout the offices in the rest of the state. End of story. Now, this is not the kind of involvement in a legal matter that would make a lawyer, even though she was in her statutory duty as attorney, performing legal services. She had equally a managerial role. She was simply saying, do something about it. Where in this record is there any evidence that the state brought forward at their hearing on the motion to disqualify some 4.5 years after the event that showed that Mrs. Maisel had given legal advice. And the cases that we've examined and cited in our briefs, there have been several approaches to how this problem might have been solved for the state without violating the very essence of the problem, which is don't disclose the confidences that you don't want that lawyer to tell. How might they do this? In one case, an affidavit was submitted in camera to the court, and the court considered that and determined that there was grounds for disqualification. In another way that I could see that it could easily be done, the state could have put on someone from the Industrial Accident Board to testify in this fashion. Was there anything that you discussed with Mrs. Maisel that involved legal confidences? Yes. And that would be as far as they would have to go. And that's the procedure that could have been followed, but they did not offer any such evidence. There is not a shred of testimony in this record that would indicate that she testified, and the only evidence is Mrs. Maisel's own testimony. I did not give legal advice. I wasn't consulted. There's simply an evidentiary problem here, and that is that they didn't meet the second prong of that test. We talked about it in terms of substantial relationships. There was no litigation pending at that time that she could have been even statutorily representing the board. So how can we say that there was a substantial relationship between the current litigation that wasn't filed until June of 1986 and the incident that happened at that time? The state says, well, Mrs. Maisel is a witness in this case. All right. Why is she a witness? We stipulated at the hearing that we were not going to call her as a witness in this case. So we can only be in the situation that the state is using it as a litigation tactic to call her as a witness to bring about her disqualification. They say that they need her testimony on the notice issue as to whether timely notice under the Tort Claims Act was given to the state. Bear in mind that Mrs. Maisel herself, sometime after leaving her employment, did file the workers' comp claim and settled that matter. The Tort Claim Act was assigned to another attorney in the office, Mr. Bruce Miller. Mr. Miller proceeded to file the suit the following year, 1986. A question exists as to whether that was timely and whether notice was given timely under the statute. They say, we're going to call Mrs. Maisel because she obviously has some evidence that has bearing on this since she was there. It makes no sense, and I will submit to you that if this case is one way or another, when this case is tried, whether my law firm tries it or not, they're not going to call Mrs. Maisel to testify because the only evidence that she could give would be harmful to their case and would not be detrimental to our client. If she had any notice, if qualitatively what she knew somehow does constitute fulfillment of the notice requirement, then it defeats the purpose of the state's calling her. They don't need to call her to prove a negative, and they run the risk that if they do call her, she proves our case. We submitted...
Have you consented to her... Has the client consented to the continued representation of the firm despite the possibility that Ms. Maisel might testify adversely?
I have to answer that question at two levels, Your Honor. Yes, he has consented, and I cannot agree with the second part of the question that she might testify adversely. On this record, and her testimony is already in this record, she says, all I knew was that an accident had happened and there might have been injuries. The problem is that the people that told her that, there's a Mr. Barnes, there's Mr. Tracy, we also submitted as part of our brief, and I believe it's in the record, that there are other people present when the accident happened. We're going to build our notice case on that. Mrs. Maisel's notice is irrelevant. So she would not be testifying adversely, and certainly if she did testify, it would have to be to say, yes, this is what I was told.
The state suggests that Mr. Tracy might change his testimony.
And I submit to you that that's a fantasy. Speculation and its absurdity. They said that the first time that they knew that they wanted to call her as a witness on this notice issue was when they took Tracy's deposition in August of 89. And they suddenly found out that there had been a conversation between Mr. Tracy. They've excerpted that in one of their pleadings, and it consists of Mr. Tracy saying, I called, and that's in the record, I called Mrs. Maisel to remind me when this thing had happened. And Mrs. Maisel told me that she thought it was just a few days before she left the board. End of story. So Mr. Tracy, to show you the vindictiveness that has come out of this case on the part of the state, they attempted to join Mr. Tracy as a third-party defendant on some specious cause of action. They have, as we've said in our brief, they have raised dilatory tactics to a new art form. And I say that particularly with reference to our point number three, which is that they waived this conflict. Now, they say the first time they could have known about it was sometime in August of 89, which is 4 months before they filed the motion, which was two business days before trial was set, on a case that was at that point just going on 4 years old, 3.5 years old. And they say, oh, well, we didn't know until Tracy's deposition. And I say horse feathers to that. They knew from the time that they filed their original answer that they were back in 86, November of 86, that they were raising notice as a defense. So they knew that all along. But they suddenly come up in 2 days before trial and say to the trial judge, well, we want them disqualified because Mrs. Mays is going to be a witness in the case. And I submit to you that it is a litigation tactic which this court has condemned. Justice Hightower wrote in the Coker case concerning this point, that it can be used as a litigation tactic to disqualify an attorney, and we've got to be mindful of that problem. Justice Gonzalez wrote in a case that came out since the time of our brief, Ayers versus Canales, which is now printed at 790 Southwest 2nd, 554, that the balancing of the interests of the legal profession as a whole, the appearance that we as lawyers and judges give to the state, must be balanced against the right of an individual citizen to have his counsel of his own choosing. I will not stand here and submit to this court that if we are disqualified, that Mr. Casillas will not end up with some other lawyer. But I can't say to you that in every situation that would be the case, that someone being disqualified right before trial like this might not then be in the position that he couldn't get counsel, and that would be unfair, and it's unfair in this circumstance. And certainly Judge Spears, the relator in this case, and I digress for a moment to mention, we pointed out in a footnote in our brief, I really don't know whether Judge Spears is properly a party in this lawsuit or not. We mentioned some ambiguous language in a prior case, I think the People's case, where the court said it had become in effect moot. And the court may, for the guidance of lawyers, tell us if the judge is properly the party in this case or not. But in any event, Judge Spears heard this evidence. She made her ruling initially, and then the state said, well, we want to put on evidence. So they put on evidence, and she said, my ruling is the same. You haven't carried your burden of proof. The Coker case sets out the test. It is an exacting standard, as Justice Hightower said. The severity of the remedy requires the movement to establish by the preponderance of the evidence the prior attorney-client relationship, that the factual matters involved were so related that it creates a genuine threat that confidences revealed to the former counsel will be divulged to the new client. Where in this record is there any possibility of that happening? There is simply no confidences that were disclosed. There is a matter of community knowledge, as is discussed in some of the other cases. There has to be something more than just a similarity. And certainly, you know, the state's going to argue to you, well, this is the identical matter. But it's not. There was no lawsuit pending at the time. In my remaining time, I want to spend a moment and cover the issue that we raised in our fifth point. As I was reviewing yesterday evening it started to occur to me that maybe I have these points somewhat in a reverse fashion, because I think factually we've shown that they have not met substantial relationship test, and they've not shown Mrs. Maisel to be a witness that is qualified in this case. The fifth point is that they have an adequate remedy by way of appeal. This court has repeatedly held, as recently, if I can find it, in a per curiam opinion in Bell Helicopter versus Walker, that you will not issue writs of mandamus to supervise or correct the incidental rulings of a trial judge when there is an adequate remedy by way of appeal. Now, in several cases, two cases out of the Dallas court, the Hoggard versus Snodgrass case and the Wadley, J.K. and Susie Wadley Memorial case cited in the brief, and then the Zardinetta case out of the San Antonio Court of Appeals, all say that the appeals court has that mandamus jurisdiction when the order is one denying the writ of mandamus. I would suggest to the court that this presents a real paradox, if you will, because by definition, the trial court has exercised the matter of discretion when it involves disqualification. Here we have the courts reviewing that. Certainly when the order is one of disqualification, I think there can be no doubt that there would be harm that can't be remedied by way of appeal. But I would submit that the ruling of the court here, the rulings of the court in Hoggard and the Wadley cases, raise at least a serious question about the efficacy of the remedy when you do in fact have the remedy by way of appeal. And I think it conflicts with the court's holding.
Let me reference you back to another issue. The Court of Appeals and perhaps both the parties seem to assume that the Rule 109 has some relevance to this case.
All right.
In view of Comment 1 to Rule 109, why isn't Rule 110 the only applicable provision?
All right, now this is the government service rule?
Right.
All right. Your Honor, first off, neither the legislature nor this court have established any artificial time period from the date that an employee leaves government service that he should not be permitted to be before that agency. Instead, what this court has done is gone back to, I would submit, or at least it has suggested that, the rule is adequately encompassed by the new disciplinary rules themselves.
Is there any question that it is the new disciplinary rules that apply in this case?
I think not, and I don't think the state has challenged that. I mean, we came into those rules literally a day before this motion to disqualify was filed. You have not set any arbitrary rule on when an attorney who has been a representative of a board or an agency of this state then could leave and go into private practice. The federal government, I believe, has such conflict of interest rules. The salient point here, Your Honor, is there simply is nothing that smells bad about this. There's nothing wrong. There's no conflict of interest here in Mrs. Maisel having represented him in front of the board. What we're doing, in fact, is what's been condemned in some of the cases, which is a double imputation of knowledge. That Mrs. Maisel's service on the board imputed knowledge to her, and then we're going to vicariously impute that to Mr. Miller in the representation of the tort claim. If the court is going to establish...
The question that I understood was, does 110 apply or 109? 1.09 or 110? Does the government service rule apply?
Your Honor, I think it probably does. I think the government service rule applies. But what I'm suggesting to the court is I can't see where anything in the rule as written creates a problem, because Mrs. Maisel did not personally and substantially participate in the matter. And that's what that rule says.
But you've done a good bit of arguing about 109, and not so much arguing about 1.10. Is there any reason for that?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that I can say that any one is more controlling than another. I mean, the personal and substantial language that's contained in 109 is no different than that which pervades the rest of the rules, which is substantial relationship. Again, we're talking about balancing here. You know, does this pass the smell test? is what it really boils down to. And this clearly does.
On another matter, there's a reference in the record at this hearing repeatedly to whether Ms. Mason was, quote, designated, end quote, as a witness.
Right.
Does that refer to answers to interrogatories or a pretrial order or anything specific?
My belief is that it does not, Your Honor.
And so there's no formal prohibition that you know of at this point that would keep one side or the other from calling Ms. Mazel as a witness should this case proceed to trial?
Save only the stipulation that was offered that we would be honor-bound as lawyers to observe that we would not call her. But I don't believe there was any interrogatories. I saw that in the statement of facts from the hearing. And I had assumed at the time in the Court of Appeals that there were, in fact, interrogatories. I don't think there are. Certainly, they're not part of this record at this time.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, this case today, I think, presents this high court with a choice of whether the new Texas disciplinary rules of professional conduct are going to be interpreted for the benefit of the public and clients, or whether or not it's going to be interpreted for the benefit of lawyers. I'm going to argue and urge the court that it should be interpreted in favoring the public and clients. Basically,
then you agree that it is the new disciplinary code that is applicable here?
Yes, Your Honor. The hearing occurred on the shortly after the first of the year. I think arguably, if we look at some of the conduct that occurred, it certainly occurred during the tenure of the old rules, but I think that we feel we're willing to go under the new rules.
Is Rule 110 the only rule to which we should refer in seeking guidance to resolve this matter?
I think that the court should look at not only 110, but 16 and 19. I think specifically that 110 is more appropriate because it does talk about a government employee. And so I have...
Given the language of comment 1 to Rule 109, why would we look at it at all? And why not look exclusively to 110?
Well, I think that we look at Rule 109 because they all carry somewhat similar burdens of proof, and that is some substantial, similar relationship. That would be the reason. I think I believe it's 1-6, is the general rule. 1-9, then, is a client with a former client. I think that's somewhat similar because that's what we have here. We have a former client and now a new client.
There is a distinction in the requirement of 110 from 109, isn't there?
Well, I think that there is a little different language in 110 because that does require a personally and substantially rule or finding as opposed to the other rule. But I think that there are some additional things that are involved.
It's a greater burden under 110, isn't it? It's a different burden.
It is a different burden. I'm not sure it's a greater burden because if we look at when we talk about matter, we have a large areas of things that can be the matters that are involved with a government employee. And I think when we look to the substantially, we have to go back and look at the preamble. And the preamble says that it not only is it a matter of great involvement, but it is also can be an incisive single issue. That would be what I would say. But when you say that it's substantially involved personally And I don't think there's any question that she was personally involved here. But when we talk about substantial, then we're looking at, I think I would argue that that is, in the terminology, in the preamble, substantial, when used in reference to degree or extent, denotes a matter of meaningful significance or involvement. And so I think when we're talking about personally and substantially related, I think still, even under 110, we still come back to the somewhat the same rules that we're talking about with our general rule of a conflict and with our specific rule of a former client and a present client.
Well, isn't there a difference between the concept of responsibility and the concept of participation as used in the rule?
I mean, there's certainly different rules. I mean, different words, but
do you view those concepts as being one and the same?
Well, as far as this case is concerned, I think that it's personally and substantially involved.
Is it the state's contention that you basically just impute participation from the title of the office?
No.
Have you shown as far as, what is the evidence as far as participation of Ms. Mizell that you would expect to offer at the time of trial? Is it all encompassed in the record here?
Well, at the time of trial, our motion was to disqualify. I would hope that she would not be here at the time of trial.
If she were a witness called by you at the time of trial, what evidence would you expect her to offer? Is there anything that's not in this record?
No, I don't think that there would be anything that is not in this record. My problem and my fear would be that if she is called to trial, there may be some things that are not in this record. As she indicated in response to one of my questions, she indicated that she had far greater knowledge of this incident than we had been previously led to believe. She indicated that she was aware that the chairs were in poor condition. She was aware that there had been numerous problems with the chairs. Those are the sorts of things, and when you take that with the specific information that she had in this case, then we have what we contend is a substantial relationship with this case.
When is the state going to decide whether they're going to call her or not?
Well, I think that in part depends upon what Mr. Tracy has testified to.
He's testified now. Are you telling me that until Tracy testifies at trial, you can't decide whether you're going to call Ms. Mizell or not?
If Mr. Tracy admits what he has testified to, then Mrs. Mizell will be a witness that will be there to refute what he has said, because she has testified under cross-examination at the hearing. After it was all said and done, the only thing that I know is that there was a problem with the chair. That is not the real issue that is important for the state. I have not, at this point, gotten to tell you why the notice issue is a very important issue.
I think I understand that, but Ms. Mizell testified at the hearing that Mr. Tracy might have told me that this person might have been hurt, but they didn't know how badly or the extent of it. Now, I know there's a good bit of testimony dancing around the issue of whether or not she knew that anybody was injured that day.
That's exactly right. And the reason that that's important is that because Mr. Tracy got information the same way that Ms. Mizell did. He got information from someone else. And those other people are going to testify that they did not know that there was an injury.
But
so
if the state can't say at this point, yes or no, that she is or is not going to testify, and about what, why should her law firm be disqualified on the potential that she might testify?
Because she is also just as great a potential for their having to call her.
They've already said they're not going to call her.
How can they possibly make that determination if that's the only way that they can show actual notice? And that's the only thing that stands between Mr. Casillas and not getting any liability in this case. And if that's what the evidence shows, that all of the witnesses up until Mrs. Mizell
testify on at trial, we really didn't know there was an injury, and that's the reason that they're trying to show actual knowledge
and show actual notice. And that's the only thing that stands between Mr. Casillas and not getting any liability in this case. And if that's what the evidence shows, that all of the witnesses up until Mrs. Mizell testified at trial, we really didn't know there was an injury, and that's the reason that they're trying to show actual knowledge of an injury by saying, well, you really hadn't noticed through the Industrial Accident Board record. That's a real issue in this case. And if all those witnesses, up until the time of after Mr. Tracy had testified, we really didn't know there was an injury, how can the law firm possibly not call Mrs. Mizell to prove their case?
So your view of Rule 3.08 is that if somebody can conceive of a way that a lawyer might be a witness in a case, and you can't tell until after you hear all the evidence in the case whether the person is going to testify or not, the lawyer, the Rule 3.08 applies.
I say that it does apply, and I say that what must occur and what didn't occur here, and the reason that we're in this position, and that's why I say that this the court has to determine this for the clients, is that there are means and methods by which the lawyer can take care of this problem prior to this time, prior to the week before trial. What they can do is that they can consult with their client. Contrary to what Mr. Fishman has said, there is no evidence that the law firm has consulted with either one of these clients, and either the Industrial Accident Board or Mr. Casillas, and gotten their approval for this problem that is presented.
You've already said the IAB is not going to prove this, period.
Certainly, but you see, it's certainly not now, but what about the time when she knew, when Mr. Casillas walked into the law firm and she was received the case, she testified that she knew that it was the same incident about which she had received information. If she had come to the Industrial Accident Board and said, look, here's what information I have, do you have any problem with that? That's what these new rules provide.
What would they say?
No, I don't know. But then the new rules shouldn't be here. If we're going to make that determination that all clients are going to say no, then we should not have provided that in our new rules.
Your client knows more now, it says, than it knew at the time this suit was filed. And it says no, it will not allow her to continue, the firm to continue representation. Why would the decision be any different other than unless you just make a mistake?
Well, but that's what our new rules provide. They say, well, in full consultation, on when problems like this arise, what you do is you go and fully consult with your client, with your former client, and get them to consent. If they consent, then we don't have a problem here. And if that had occurred, then we wouldn't have a problem. But Ms. Mizell, what we're in the position of doing, we're in the position of finding that out. And then they're coming to us and saying, aha, you didn't find out soon enough.
Well, you say you didn't find out soon enough. You say you found out from Mr. Tracy. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Well, he's the executive officer of your client, is he?
No, he is not. Well, he was at one time. And that raises a very interesting question. How did Mr. Casillas and the law firm find out about Mr. Tracy? Because the case was set for trial and everyone was ready to go. The plaintiff filed a motion for continuance, and suddenly Mr. Tracy is found to prove a very important element of their case. He is not one that we knew about, because the only people who knew about this case were the pre-hearings officer who was there and his boss in the San Antonio office. That's all the information that we had other than Mrs. Foster. We did not know that Mr. Tracy had any information about this case. It was the plaintiff who found Mr. Tracy, lo and behold, 4 years after the incident. And then, of course, Mr. Tracy is the one who consults with Ms. Mizell about his testimony prior to the time that he gives his deposition.
Do you claim that there's reference in the record of the hearing? Do But do you claim specifically that Ms. Mizell has any confidences imparted to her by the board?
Your Honor, I can't say other than what she testified to at the hearing. That she testified that she said, I don't have anything. All I know is what I've been told. She testified about that in about three different ways. Then she added gratuitously, I did know that there was a problem with the chairs. They looked awful. We'd had problems with the chairs. We weren't getting proper funding. I don't know if called and asked specifically about those things, what information she would have. But I don't believe that the corporate standard requires us to go into that, and as a matter of fact, that's not something that you are supposed to go into once you have shown that there is a substantial relationship between this lawsuit, between the information in this lawsuit and the information of that prior representation.
Well, but 1.09 refers to representation, and I don't understand how Ms. Mizell ever represented the internal, the Industrial Accident Board in connection with the, Mr. Casillas' claim, didn't you?
Well, 8307 Section 2 says that she acts in the capacity of legal advisor. The question that was asked and that is referenced in the plaintiff's motion, in response to our motion to disqualify, is one question that came from Mr. Tracy's deposition. And that question is this. Okay, now following, well, after you explained the circumstances to Peggy, what was her advice as legal counsel to the board? That was the question in the deposition that raised our concern about this being an attorney-client relationship. And here's what she said. Here's what Mr. Tracy said. Well, if she said something to the effect, well, you know, if those chairs are bad, we need to get rid of them. Let me remind the court, I don't... It is advice. Let me say this.
Does it strike you as legal representation?
I certainly think in 1986 that could have been advice, because I recall a time when counsel for all of our state agencies were having information about claims brought to them, so that what they could do is to order an investigation that would be within the confines of the attorney work product. And that is the sort of information that legal counsel would give, so that when that investigation was done and someone said, well, was it a part of attorney work product? That was before the time that the court had spoken that there had to be some substantial reason of knowing that there was going to be a lawsuit filed. So I think, yes, that is the nature of legal representation.
Well, if a janitor says these chairs are falling apart, that's not legal advice. But if a lawyer says these chairs are falling apart, that's legal representation.
Well, but you see, what this does is that this comes from the executive director. It's information that comes up through the organization. It comes through the executive director. And that executive director is then told to go out and do something. It seems to me, Your Honor, I'm not going to tell you that this is of the nature of the broadest and best type of legal advice. I'm saying that this meets the test. If it doesn't meet the test, we're going to be quibbling over a lot of things as to what does meet the test. And that's why I say that these rules are for lawyers. They're not for clients. They're not for the IAB. These rules are for lawyers, and by the ruling of this court, it needs to make lawyers sensitive to those issues. This problem could be solved and would have been solved if Ms. Mizell had been sensitive to the issues. If she had said, when that case came in, hey, this is a matter about which I have some information. I don't know whether it's proper for me to be involved in this. Certainly she was not involved in the tort claim. I don't know why. Was there some problem there? Is that she did not feel like she could represent the state or represent Mr. Casillas against the state because she did know some information. The problem is that she never goes to the state and says anything. And that is a provision that allows the lawyer to avoid these problems. It also solves the problem of waiver. If information is given, then we don't have to wait on the opposing side to come in at some late date. We've given them information upon which they can act at an early time. And I think that that's what the rules and the way that the rules ought to be interpreted for the benefit of the client and the public. Instead of the clients and the public having to keep up with the lawyers, let the lawyers be aware of what their responsibilities are and to act accordingly within the new rules.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Mr. Kane apparently has me at some degree of a disadvantage because he has elaborated to the court on matters that I'm not aware of that are in the record. I don't know what the circumstances were of Mr. Tracy's deposition. I know there's nothing in this record save an excerpt from his deposition. Nothing was offered at the hearing on the motion to disqualify, and it's only through the fortuitous circumstance that there is a portion of his testimony quoted in the pleadings that we know that the extent of the conversation that he had with Mrs. Maisel was to jog his memory as to when this all took place. All those quotations from the deposition, I don't know where they are in the record, and I would submit to the court that that is really not the issue here anyway. The state is ducking the issue. They're ducking the basic question here by trying to, take the high ground and say, well, we have to have lawyers, policemen, so we all know that. That's what the rules say. The question that we're here about is simply one about which reasonable lawyers could disagree, and that is language that comes out of some of the cases that we're citing in our brief, that Mrs. Maisel did not have an obligation, if she didn't feel that there was a conflict of interest, to come forward and say so. Where was the state during this 3.5 years? They knew that this law firm was the attorneys of record. They knew that Mrs. Maisel was with that firm. They knew that whatever information and confidences it is that she's supposed to have possessed were there all along. They say, well, we just discovered it in August. Even if that were the case, what did they do between August and December? Well, they say that Ms. Phillips was on maternity leave, and there's a question as to what's in or not in the record as to when she actually left on maternity leave. It doesn't really matter. I don't think that going on maternity leave is like going into a coma or something like that. I don't understand why she couldn't have said to someone else among the hundreds of other lawyers in the Attorney General's office, listen, before I go on maternity leave here in a couple of weeks, I just had a deposition where an issue has come up. Why do they wait until she returns and they bring this out 2 days before trial? That's where the question of lawyer conduct comes into this case. That's where the question of the state using all of its resources and its power to deprive this man of his day in court and the counsel of his choosing becomes the real ethical question in this case. We're not going to be painted with that brush that Mrs. Maisel did something wrong in this case. She did nothing wrong. She didn't even, they asked why did she not represent him in the trial court matter. The answer is very simple. She's not a trial court lawyer. She doesn't do that kind of work. Period. Plain and simple. Now, they to bootstrap their argument about her supposed knowledge, they refer to a part of the hearing where she volunteered that she recalled that the state hadn't given very much funding and they needed new chairs in the offices. Well, there's two problems with that. First off, they objected to that response, and the judge sustained the objection, so it's not even part of the record. But even if it is, we go back to the basic fact that the law firm that Mr. Casillas, through his counsel of record, has stipulated that they will not call Mrs. Maisel as a witness. This is a choice that is made in private consultation between lawyer and client. It is not for the state of Texas or any other opponent in a litigation matter to insert themselves between lawyer and client to make that decision. That's what's inappropriate here. Now,
I had, in response to Justice Doggett's question, I had gotten the rule numbers mixed up. 110 is the government service rule. And again, I would go back to the fact that it does say personal and substantial involvement. If that is the issue in this case, where was the personal and substantive involvement in this matter? Where did what did she do? What, as Justice Heck said, do you call that legal advice when she said check out the chairs? This was a matter of knowledge that was there for all to see. Mrs. Maisel was not uniquely the one to testify about that. If we're not calling her, the state shouldn't be able to disqualify us.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument and the second call. The court will take another brief recess.
The audience will please rise.